Bring the meeting to order. We have a quorum. And Representative Magnus, would you like to move the minutes?
Yes, I would, Mr.
And Magnus moves the minutes for approval. Are there any corrections or additions? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Today we have the pleasure of having an overview from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I'd like to welcome you to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning.
Commissioner, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
I am Commissioner Corrigan from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And with me here at the table today is Art Dunn, the Director of the Office of Environmental Assistance. And I'll be starting out today with about a 20 to 25 minute overview of our agency, and then Art will follow me. So I'm glad to see that everyone made it out of bed this morning. I know I watched the weather last night, and it was, you could describe it as the weatherman's holiday, all the cold weather. I kept thinking to myself, but we're Minnesotans. This is what it's all about. So at any rate, today I'm going to talk a little bit about our mission at the PCA and our vision and how we've taken that mission and vision and translated it into some strategies, our strategic plan, and then how we focus our energies at the PCA. What kinds of things, what kinds of tactics do we use in order to fulfill that mission, vision, and finally our strategies. So the intent today is just to give you a broad overview of what we're about at the agency and not to delve too far down into the details, and I hope we have plenty of time then for questions as we move forward. So with that, our mission, pretty simple, is to help Minnesotans protect and improve the environment. That's you and me, that's our industrial partners, that's our environmental groups. It's all of the folks that we interact with at the agency. Our vision, again, pretty simple. We all want clean and clear air. We all want land that supports desired uses, clean and sustainable groundwater systems, and clean, fishable, and swimmable surface waters. This mission and this vision haven't changed very much since 1967, when our agency was first created. But what has changed is the state of the environment. And it struck me the other day, I have a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old. It struck me the other day that they have not seen some of the environmental difficulties that have been around for some of the rest of us. And one story that I like to tell, and I probably will repeat myself a number of times, we live in Bayport, which is very close to the St. Croix River. And we go to the beach in Bayport often. And a couple of summers ago, when my kids were in early elementary school, we were sitting on the beach, and a bald eagle flew down about 10 feet away from us. We could feel the wash from its wings and snagged a fish right out of the water, maybe 30 feet in front of us. And I was so excited, I turned to my son and I said, "Edgar, look at that. That's a bald eagle." And he turned to me and he said, "Yeah." And that's because he's grown up in a place where bald eagles nest. Now, when I was his age, there were no eagles. And that's the difference. And that's due to the great work of the PCA. It's due to the vision and the leadership of the legislature in helping the agency and Minnesotans guide and move important environmental programs forward. And that progress is something that we all enjoy now. Going forward, we have some new issues on the table. The issues of 20, 30 years ago were all about point sources, about the kinds of pollution that comes from the end of wastewater discharge pipes or from smokestacks. The kind of pollution today that we need to deal with is non-point source, the diffuse pollution that comes from each one of us. And so our mission to help Minnesotans protect and improve the environment becomes that much more critical. And us following through with the mission is equally as important. So some quick vital statistics about who we are. At our agency, we have 750 full-time equivalents. That's our complement. We actually have about 730 folks that work at our agencies. Those people are spread across 8 offices throughout our state. We have a number of regional offices that you can see on the map. We think this is really important. We're very committed to local service delivery. We think that that's the best model for environmental improvement and assistance, in particular compliance assistance. And our budget on an annual basis is $126 million. I've already talked about the mission and the vision. That needed to be translated into some strategies. And in your packet, we have included our MPCA goal tree. It's the colored diagram in the back, and I apologize for the size of print. I can't read it myself, but I want to invite you just to take a look at it and also to click on our website. It's on there in electronic form. The point here is that we've taken our mission and our vision, developed high-level goals and objectives, and you can see the key areas where we're working at the agency right now. This strategic plan is directly linked to our vision. It's our roadmap. We picked about a 10 to 12-year horizon. It's a long-term vision, a long-term strategy to help us get to where we are. And it helps guide what we do on an annual basis. And so we annually review our strategic plan and then on a quarterly basis review our work plans to make sure that what we're doing at our agency is moving us forward. We want to make sure that we're doing the work that's actually going to result in positive environmental benefits for Minnesota. Having a plan is the basis then for our priorities. And at our agency, we have a mantra, and that is our priorities drive our work and drive our spending and our budget. Our spending and our budget do not drive our priorities. And we've really worked very hard to make sure that we're fully funding those priorities. At the core, we are a regulatory agency that will always be a critical part of what we do and how we fulfill our mission. Those core regulatory programs, of course, include permitting, but also emergency response. And we've had a number of emergency responses this year that I think have hit the news. One that was very significant for us was the Rosemont Mercury cleanup. And that's the kind of service that the PCA provides on a day-to-day basis. In addition, our contaminated site cleanups, that would be our Superfund programs, our voluntary programs around land cleanup and our petrol fund and leaking underground storage tank programs as well. So those are our core regulatory programs, the programs that will never go away, and for good reason. Then the next level is our non-point priorities. And I've already talked a little bit about why non-point source pollution, both in air and in water, are so critical. I won't get into great detail today, but our number one priority outside of our core regulatory programs is the restoration of impaired waters in Minnesota. And I know many of you have already heard about the Clean Water Legacy Act. We'll hear more about that as time goes on. But it's a critical piece of how we intend at our agency and with our partners to meet head-on the challenges of impairment in our surface waters across Minnesota.
Commissioner?
Yes.
If you could, for just a moment, yesterday I understand there was a question before the committee. It said if the Clean Water Act has actually been around since 1972, why is the impaired waters issue so critical now? Why has this become such a urgent issue? And maybe a short little history behind that may be helpful.
Sure.
Did I cover that question okay?
Well, there. Right now, as an agency, we are required through the Clean Water Act to list water bodies that do not meet their designated uses. And designated uses are things like fishing, swimming, agricultural use, drinking water, and so forth. And all of the waters across Minnesota are actually classified for designated uses. And those uses then are connected to water quality standards and water quality criteria, so in-stream standards. And it's our job across Minnesota to monitor streams and lakes and rivers and make sure that those water bodies meet their designated uses. Most of the water bodies across Minnesota are designated for recreation, warm water, fisheries, and swimming, full body contact. So, as an agency, a big part of what we do is monitoring and assessment. The Clean Water Act requires us to list the water bodies that don't meet their designated uses. So those are the water bodies that, for whatever reason, whether it's from any kind of source, don't meet the water quality standards. And those water bodies are put on our impaired waters list, which we then send into the federal government. It's part of our responsibilities as a delegated water quality permitting program. Once a water body is listed in Minnesota, we have to come up with a fix-it plan. And that fix-it plan is called a total maximum daily load, a TMDL. We have 13 years in which to come up with that plan. And essentially what that plan does is it parses out the various sources that are contributing to that impairment and allocates them. The kicker on all of this is that until that plan is approved by the federal government, there can be no new or expanded discharge that would cause or contribute to that particular impairment. That hasn't been a problem for us until quite recently, over the last couple of years. We have now 2,000 water bodies on our impaired waters list. And that's because we've been plugging and chugging and doing our jobs at the PCA and following through with the requirements of the Clean Water Act. It has now started in Minnesota to become difficult in those areas where we have impaired water bodies to develop in the way that we want to develop. And so what we're facing right now are crises in very small areas of our state, and potential crisis across our state in terms of an economic development freeze, if you will, until we can figure out that fix-it plan. And let me give you just a sense for what I'm talking about in terms of what could be on our plate here in the next couple of years. Right now, we have listed Lake Pepin, which is a lake, actually, in the middle of the Mississippi River. And many of you are probably aware of where it's located, but it's right outside of Lake City. The unique aspect of Lake Pepin is that it is actually at the bottom of the St. Croix River Basin, the Minnesota River Basin, and the Upper Mississippi River Basin. Lake Pepin receives runoff essentially from all of those basins, which cover about 50% of the land area in Minnesota. Lake Pepin is now listed because of nutrients, so phosphorus in particular. As a result, we now have to come up with the fix-it plan for Lake Pepin, which will cover 50% of the land area in Minnesota. That also happens to be one of our prime industrial corridors, as well as the area in Minnesota that's growing by leaps and bounds. The corridor from the Twin Cities up to St. Cloud, and all of those areas that need additional wastewater treatment services. And so we are looking at a potential train wreck in the next couple of years until we can get the Lake Pepin TMDL out the door. That's happening across Minnesota. And in some places in the northern part of the state, the issues aren't around nutrients so much, they're around mercury. And other issues, they're around total suspended sediments and solids and other conventional pollutants. But the bottom line is we're going to be adding to our list. Our scientists tell me that by the time we completely assess all of the water bodies in Minnesota, we could be looking at about 10,000 impairments. And when you think about the geographic distribution of where those are, it is a significant impact on our ability to compete, not just on a national level, but on a global level. And it touches all of us. It touches agriculture, it touches urban development, and it touches industrial development. So it's a critical thing that we need to address. And we, as I said earlier, are working with a number of partners in moving that Clean Water Legacy Act or some iteration of that forward during this legislative session.
Commissioner, it's my understanding that the history also, because it has been 30 years since 1972 when the Act went in place, and we know that the water conditions at that time was, we had rivers in the United States that could actually burn. And so I think that the tremendous amount of effort has gone into the point source.
Right.
And isn't it that we've now have kind of progressed to the next phase where we're moving away from point source? Is everyone familiar with the term point source? End of pipe pollution? So, and that that now that we're going into the next phase, that's really what is causing this sense of urgency, as well as the lawsuits that are occurring around the United States. Maybe you could give us a little background on some of that.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's absolutely right. Minnesota, like every other state, was focused, as I said earlier, on the point sources of pollution, those end-of-pipe discharges, whether it's to the air or to the water. And we were able to create a significant amount of environmental gain, as I said in my story about the eagles. That's how we got there. Now what we're looking at is the next challenge, which is the non-point source pollution. And all along we've been looking at non-point source pollution, but it hasn't been a priority necessarily for the federal government because of more pressing matters. And we have been managing on a state basis our own watershed program, the Clean Water Partnership Program, which was always intended to deal with non-point pollution. But now what we're finding from our data, again, is that non-point pollution is really the major contributor for us in terms of water pollution. And again, we've been doing these listings, and now we've gotten to a critical mass where the pain is being felt across Minnesota, and that's where I think the crisis is. But I want to emphasize that we have small crises going on across the state based on new development projects that are having trouble moving forward. We're trying to be in a crisis avoidance mode for the rest of the state. We don't want the rest of Minnesota to suffer. And when I talk about crisis in these small areas, as Representative Osment and the chair mentioned, the crisis is not just an environmental crisis, it's actually a legal crisis for us as well in some areas, where in the places where we have impairments and development has been proposed, whether it's wastewater treatment or some other new discharge or expanded discharge, we have been named in several lawsuits, primarily around municipal wastewater discharge expansion. But we see that as a potential problem for us going forward, not because we're doing anything that we shouldn't be doing in Minnesota, but because we would prefer to be able to set environmental policy and in rules and legislation rather than having policy dictated from the judicial bench. We think that the best way to do it is through our own action and pro-action and leadership.
In my sense of what those that do not believe that there's an environmental priority on this issue need to be paying attention to the economic priority that this particular program can impact. It's my understanding that underneath the Clean Water Act that any citizen can bring a lawsuit to stop a project if that project has the potential of increasing the impairments within the identified or increasing the TMDLs within the impaired waters. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
So it's very important for Minnesota's economy that we pay attention and try to head off the need for people to resort to lawsuits. If we can be doing the right thing, then we can continue to grow. Otherwise, they can really stop our growth in our state. Representative McGinnis, you had a question?
Not a question. It's just a comment in how we talk to people about this problem. And as I've been talking to folks about it and using the term non-point, the assumption from the hearer is that it is pollution coming from the air rather than where it is actually coming from. So I have, when I describe the pollution then, I say, well, it's a lot of smaller points. And so small point pollution seems to be a better descriptor when we're talking to people who are not us and kind of know the terms of art. So I just, sometimes you have to describe a problem in order for people to accept it a little better. And I just point that out.
When it's non-point, it comes from all those issues, stormwater runoff, as well as from the air. As I recall, in the phosphorus study, a significant amount of phosphorus comes from the air, from the dust that's blowing around, and that impacts on our waters. And so it's hitting us from all over. Some of it's easier to control. Some of it's virtually out of our control. So it'll be a very challenging period of time for us to work in.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, what do we do, or what would be your action? Well, what's the recourse if it's in the natural progression of things, which we know is forever changing, and where we, they're literally in Minnesota, are areas of no people, so we know it's not the people factor polluting. So you got a natural progression going, or you've got wildlife, plants and animals that are causing this, or the ground itself is contributing to the mercury. And wanna, so then, what do you do there,
Mr. Chair, Representative? That is more of an issue around the use classification. When I said earlier that most of the water bodies in Minnesota are classified for specific uses, and those are fishing and swimming in particular, what we do when we have a situation like that, and I know that this has come up a couple of times just over the last year or so, where folks have come in and said, look, the use classification for this water body that's on your list is not right. It doesn't make any sense. And so our scientists go back and say, okay, we're going to take a look at it. And there are several off-ramps during that classification or reclassification process that can be used in order to make sure that the water body that we're looking at is classified correctly. If it is classified correctly and there are impairments, we have to go through what I explained, the fix-it plan, essentially.
And I was sorry to take you off track on your presentation, but some of these issues are important because I know people are talking in the legislature, and around here perceptions sometimes can overrule facts, and so I need to kind of head off some of those inaccurate perceptions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to offer to this committee and to any other committee that our agency would be happy to come and talk about impaired waters and the science behind it, as well as how we would like to approach it going forward. So let me just finish here on the program priorities. We've talked about impaired waters. Another critical area for us on the non-point or the small point pollution is air. About 50% of our air pollutant load now comes from mobile sources. So those are cars, off-road vehicles, trucks, and small engines and so forth. And so this is an area where, again, we need to focus. The critical thing, the takeaway on this, is that we have our core regulatory programs and they speak to a certain amount of pollution and a certain way to get that pollution out of the environment. On the non-point source side, we don't have the regulatory tools that we have on the point source side. And so this area is an area where we need to reach out with technical assistance and with partnerships and other creative ways to deal with the problem, because regulation and our regulatory tools will not get us the kind of gains that we need to make in order to get the environmental improvements that we need in the future. So the way that we are approaching some of our priorities are through partnerships. The Clean Water Initiative and the Water Cabinet is a key area where, as an administration, we get together on a monthly basis. All of the commissioners who have responsibility for water programs across Minnesota get together and put together our own strategies across agencies, also our own funding strategies across agencies, to make sure that, again, we're doing the right work and we're fully funding our priorities as an administration.
I think that's a unique approach. I believe they have coordination between agencies. Not that it's a unique thought. It's just unique that it's actually happening. I think it's great that this administration has taken that on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it actually is working. Over this last budget session, we had some very painful at times discussions about where we needed to head as an administration in the water area. The next is the Clean Water Legacy Act, which we've already talked about a little bit. It's focusing on restoration of impaired waters and protection of our high resource value waters. Other partnerships that I've talked about over the last couple of years that you've probably heard about, Clean Air Minnesota is a partnership that incorporates state agencies as well as environmental groups and industry to come up with ways for us to focus on that non-point air problem and voluntary approaches and voluntary strategies to reduce the non-point air and, in some cases, the point sources that contribute to ozone formation and PM, particulate matter, that's very, very small, which we're finding is a very significant health concern for folks in Minnesota and across the nation. We also have a technical assistance division, which is focused on delivering the assistance in those non-point areas to make sure that we have the full toolbox that we need in order to meet the challenges at the local level. And today, I know Art is going to be talking a lot about the Office of Environmental Assistance and what they do, but also about how we coordinate our work and how we would like to make that coordination much more formal going forward. And Art will be speaking more on that in a couple of minutes. Process improvement is another way that we meet our strategic plan and our mission. We are very focused in our agency on process improvement, but I want to make the point that process improvement is not a trade-off between fast and good. We are committed at our agency to make sure that whatever kind of improvements that we make, we maintain the highest quality of environmental products that we can. And in fact, we think we've done that. One of the tools that we use at our agency for process improvement is Six Sigma, which is just simply a set of analytical tools and a methodology to use them to help you identify what parts of the process really affect the outcome, and then work on those parts of the process and make sure that they're controlled so you get the outcomes that you want. Right now, we've used Six Sigma primarily in our permitting processes, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the results that we've seen just over the last year in our water permitting project. Minnesota BizKnife is a process that we own jointly with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED, and it's intended to give new business, whether it's expanding or brand new to Minnesota, a transparent, certain timeline for environmental permitting. And over the last year, BizKnife has been around for just a year now. They've had 395 entities use the service, and about 30 of those have been very complex in terms of environmental permitting. We've had some great successes there. We have taken our average for major permitting processes down from about 180 days to 107 in some cases. And there's one special case which I'll note just because it something that doesn't happen very often. We actually had the permittee, after they've received all their permits, plant trees in commemoration of the great work that the PCA did in helping them move through the permitting process in a way that was transparent and satisfying, but also environmentally top-notch. So that was something that I don't think has happened before at the PCA. Other areas where we've really focused are the mining work group and also a mercury permitting work group for the northern tier of our state. And then finally, internally, we have an environmental results management system. So this is the way that we make sure that the work that we're doing and the measurements that we're making add up to results on the ground. This is just a chart to show you what kind of process improvement we're really looking at the PCA, and Six Sigma has helped us get there. Over time, incremental improvement is great, but every once in a while you need to jumpstart it. And what you see here is simply a chart that shows what kind of step change improvements we're really trying to achieve in our permitting processes at our agency. The takeaway here is that for many years, prior to about 2003, we were issuing 10% of our permits in less than 180 days. And this is for the water quality regulars, or medium to smaller permits. We have about 1,200 of those across the state. So about 10% were being reissued or issued in less than 6 months. We set a goal for ourselves using our Six Sigma methodologies to issue those permits, 90% of those permits actually, within 180 days or less. And that's what that blue line looks like. That's our goal. The red line is where we are today. And actually, it's not quite accurate. We're up a little bit above 60%, turning towards 70%. So that's an incredible gain. The takeaway on this one is that it was done with no new resources, just a different way of doing our work. And the Six Sigma methodologies require that you maintain the quality of the product. So it's not fast at the expense of good. We have an air quality permitting project that we're working on as well, and a contracting project where we've taken 5,000 hours out of our contracting typical process, and a number of other projects. One that I like to talk about a lot is our training program, where we've designed a new training program for our wastewater treatment operators using these same kinds of principles. I think it's really important whenever I talk to groups to really emphasize that Minnesota has been a leader in the environmental arena, and we continue to be leaders in the environmental arena. We've talked about a couple of things that are first in the nation already. Our clean water cabinet is first in the nation. The Clean Water Act, or the Clean Water Legacy Act, is a first-in-the-nation kind of proposal. Our land cleanups have been first-in-the-nation in the past and continue to be trendsetting for the rest of the nation. On the air quality side, we enjoy, in Minnesota, a very rare, I guess you could say, honor in that our major metropolitan areas all are in attainment of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. Now, that doesn't mean a whole lot to the normal person walking down the street, but it means a heck of a lot to the folks who do business in Minnesota, because it means that they don't have to invest in very expensive and difficult to maintain and operate pollution control equipment. We're only one of three major metropolitan areas that attain all of the air standards. The other two are Miami and Seattle, and as you can imagine, their geography helps them quite substantially. We're in the middle of the country. They're on the ends, and they have oceans that contribute to their air quality, while we have the South and the West that contributes to ours. So this is a great boon for us, and from an economic standpoint as well as an environmental standpoint and a human health standpoint. The Metropolitan Emission Reduction Project, the MERP project, I won't talk about at length, but it is a first-in-the-nation project, a billion-dollar investment, voluntary investment from our utility to take two legacy coal plants and move them to natural gas, and then to take a large coal plant and provide state-of-the-art pollution control equipment to reduce air emissions. This project alone is the single largest improvement in air quality in Minnesota since the Clean Air Act was promulgated. That's how big it is. And that, again, was a voluntary project, a huge leadership position on the part of Xcel Energy. Water quality, first in the nation effort on a mercury TMDL that looks at the mercury impairments for our waters on a regional basis so that we can move forward on permitting strategies. And a voluntary mercury reduction program in Minnesota that has put Minnesota at the forefront of states in mercury reduction. We have reduced mercury emissions in Minnesota by 68% since 1990. That's more than any other state. We will be on track to meet the legislature's goal of 70% by 2005, and we would like to do more. On the land side, our VIP program has been used as a template for many other programs across the nation. We also have a closed landfill program that is a first in the nation, which Art will talk about at length. So the idea here is that Minnesota is a leader. Minnesota has been a leader, and Minnesota will continue to be a leader in environmental protection and improvement. So adding it all up, setting priorities, working the priorities, managing the priorities, resourcing our priorities, building partnerships outside of government with all sectors, and improving our processes within our agency add up to real environmental results. And now I'd like to turn it over to Art, unless there are any other questions.
Any questions, Commissioner? Representative Pennis?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, how are the, this is a national act now, how are the other states stepping up to the plate? Are they equal to doing similar to Minnesota? Because, of course, we're not an isolated place here out in the middle of the ocean. We're getting some of it from the whatever direction.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are a number of things that are going on nationally right now from an air quality perspective that will affect Minnesota quite substantially. I think probably the most important are the mercury proposals for the electrical generation sector that are on the table right now from the federal government. Those proposals, whether it's a rule or legislation, will ask for reductions in mercury as well as sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide. And so that will help our air quality substantially, because most of our air, actually, in particular in the summer months, the air masses that move into our state come primarily from the south. And those are the days when typically, right, I shouldn't say typically, when we have had air quality alert days, and many of you have probably seen those in the newspapers. Those are about ozone and in some cases particulate matter. So we anticipate that in the next couple of years there will be substantial changes in the way that the federal government takes a look at the utility power generation sector in particular.
Representative Corey.
Chair and Commissioner, I know we set pretty good policy-wise and ideology and policy or plans and things like that in Minnesota for the future, but how do we rate just generally against other states in the nation for how we fund towards fixing the issue of the impairments and the pollution? Just general overall, do we, compared to other states, how many dollars do we put towards the entire effort? Can you tell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, it's really a difficult comparison to make because a fellow that I know likes to talk about Kansas. In Kansas, they have one lake. And so so the impaired waters issue for them is pretty manageable. In Minnesota, we have 14,000 lakes, and we have 92,000 miles of streams. And so Minnesota actually is probably in the top three states in terms of the amount of water that we need to deal with. And the more water you have, the more potential there is for impairment. Our spending on water quality, to be frank, has not kept up with the regulatory program needs that we've had in the past. About 46% of our budget on the water quality regulatory side comes from permit fees, and the rest comes from federal sources. And in fact, for the last couple of bienniums, at least three bienniums, we've moved resources from our lower program priorities, which have been the mature land programs, into water quality to make sure that, as I said earlier, we're funding our priorities, and we will continue to do that.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, to their credit, the folks who are supporting the legacy bill or proposal have really been out and about and talking about what needs to be done. And so we're getting feedback, a lot of feedback now. And I see kind of three big things that we need to deal with, and two I think you can help with kind of getting ahead of the curve and ahead of time, not for today, but people want to know how the money will be spent. And so I think it's important that when this proposal actually comes forward, we have a fairly detailed work plan so people can see where specifically these new dollars will go. And the second thing I hear a lot about is people saying, well, are we always going to be just messing up, cleaning up, messing up, cleaning up, messing up, cleaning up? Are there any things we can do to stop the messing up part first? And I think that the good example there is the potassium, I mean, not phosphorus legislation that we did. And so I would ask, what are your top two, three, four things like that that we could do at a prevention level? Not for today, but when this comes up. So those would be my requests.
Commissioner, I believe that the can confirm that the Clean Water Legacy Act will have significant efficiencies, accountabilities, and prevention provisions within it. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
We have the partnership group that's been working on this takes that very seriously, the prevention piece of it and protection piece of the Legacy Act. And I probably have been remiss. Our focus, of course, at the agency often is around cleanup, but this particular piece of policy and potential legislation really speaks to the protection aspects as well. On the if I may, on the other reactive side of things, I think Representative Wagenius brings up a great point. I know that Art will have a lot to say about OEA success in changing behaviors, in particular in the solid waste area, and going forward with our proposal for a new Department of Environmental Protection, we're really focused on that prevention piece, taking the models that have worked in the past in different areas and applying them to the water area and to the air nonpoint area so that we can start to do more of that prevention. Regulation and regulatory approaches often do not lend themselves to prevention. It's an after the fact, whereas the kinds of things that OEA does and hopefully our new department will be doing are focused much more laser-like on changing behaviors.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagenius kind of started where I was interested in, but thank you, Commissioner, for your overview. I'm just curious, just real briefly, what is the greatest need that the MPCA has to fulfill its mission, in your opinion? What is the greatest need that you see right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's a broad question, and I'm gonna take it in pieces. Probably the most important thing that we need is leadership, and not leadership from me, but leadership from the policymakers and decision makers that are here today and elsewhere. We need the vision and the leadership that we've seen in the past around, for example, our state Superfund program. 20 years ago, the legislature decided that they were going to move forward on a state cleanup program before even the feds did. And because of that leadership, because of that vision, we are now in an enviable position in Minnesota where we have pretty much licked the hazardous waste disposal problems of the late 1980s and 1990s. We are in a position with our Superfund program where we have about 20, 30, 40 sites coming in and about the same number being delisted every day. We don't anticipate that changing over time. That vision is the same kind of vision we would like to see applied, for example, in the water, the Clean Water Legacy Act. I would like to be able to come back 20 years from now and say, because of the vision and the leadership of the legislature and other policymaking groups, we've been able to lick the impaired waters problem so that our children and their children will have the resources available to them that we did today. In other areas, of course, resources we would like to see a greater emphasis put on water and our water regulatory programs. We think that that's pretty important going forward, and that's something that that we've been doing. We would like to see more of an emphasis placed on it from a budgetary standpoint going forward. But it's more than resources. It's making sure that those resources are used wisely. And I hope that we've shown you today that we want to use resources effectively and efficiently and make sure that, again, the work that needs to get done is getting done, and it's getting done well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Wagini has touched on something here, and I was thinking along the same lines. Maybe she didn't ask the question quite direct enough, and I don't think she got the answer to her question. I would like to know, on the impaired waters issue, what are the top three or four items that are creating the problem? You say non-point source issues. Well, we must know what some of these top three or four items are that are polluting our waters to create this problem. Do we know what those are?
Mr. Chair, we do, actually. From the perspective of water sources, stormwater is an important source, and that's stormwater from urban areas. We also know that runoff in our agricultural areas is a significant source, and I'm talking about of conventional kinds of pollutants like sediment and nutrients like phosphorus and so forth. Fecal coliform from straight pipe septic systems as well as non-functioning septic systems is a problem both in our urban areas and in our rural areas. On the mercury side, we know that 90% of the mercury that comes to Minnesota, to Minnesota waters, comes from the air. And so we have air deposition issues as well. Those are just a handful, but those are the primary impairments that we're seeing today and where we think that they're coming from. Now, I'm saying this on a broad basis. Each individual TMDL, or fix-it plan, is tasked with figuring out where the source of the impairment is coming from and then how to resolve that, how to reduce that impact, how to cut it, essentially, so that the water bodies where it's being received can eventually meet their uses.
Commissioner, because most of our environmental programs and regulations have really dealt with things that are in a statewide perspective with regard to the solutions, In the impaired waters effort, isn't it because we're dealing with TMDLs in a particular water body that we'll really be dealing with those solutions watershed by watershed, rather than having one size fits all and this is what everyone will have to do? It will really depend upon what's going on in that watershed that's causing the impairments. That's the reason why that we don't really have an absolute model that you can go out there and just say, here's what you need to do, and it'll take care of it. It's because it really needs to be designed to the specific problems in that watershed. Yeah, that's the concept I have. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chairman, that's absolutely accurate. It's we know that there are things that are contributing to these impairments that are broad, as I said, runoff, septic systems, that kind of thing. We have programs and regulations and rules in place to deal with those. Now what we need to do with the TMDL, these fix-it plans, which are very, very local, focus on, as you said, the watershed where the impairment is happening, to determine what is causing that particular impairment. Is it the agricultural runoff? Is it the new city development that's gone in, if we're talking about sediments? What is it in particular? And that's why it takes so long to come up with these fix-it plans, because they're based in good science. And then based in the good science that leads to implementation at the local level.
Came up to my attention in a water body down in my area that there was a fecal coliform problem, and people were starting to be concerned about the septic systems automatically as to where the focus was. But they're able to fingerprint the fecal coliform, and it turned out that the fecal coliform problem was actually coming from the high deer population in the area. So there's natural things that are happening that we won't be able to do anything about. But as we can identify those, I think that'll all be taken into account. If plans will be put together with lots of local participation, and therefore we'll have common sense prevail. That's why we want to keep this out of the federal court system, because they can really start to do things in a judicial manner and not just kind of exclude common sense and just try to do that one-size-fits-all type of an approach, which I think would be devastating for us. Representative Hackett.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the point I'm trying to get to here, and it was touched on, Representative Pennis pressed on it the other day too, we've had some of these laws in place for a long time, specifically about septic systems and straight pipes. We don't allow this. And why is this continuing to happen? I mean, at the local level, we have inspectors and people that go out and check these things out. Why aren't these septic systems being brought into compliance? Is it a local issue that's not getting done? Why isn't that happening? And why aren't these straight pipes being taken care of? If we know where there's straight pipes, why aren't we going out there and arresting these people or fining them or getting something done with these things? I mean, these are laws that are already in place. Why haven't they been getting done? That's what I'm upset about.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, you're right, there are laws in place, and there are laws at the state level as well as local ordinances. And the bottom line on a lot of this is the practical and reasonable approach. And while we would like to be able to deal with what we think are very serious environmental programs right away, we also realize that there is a significant cost associated with that. And that's from environmental protection and a human health standpoint. We deal with the most egregious, of course, and then we try to come up with solutions for, in fact, what ends up being, in many areas, communities that can't afford significant wastewater treatment and funding sources and resources that are not necessarily available to help them. And so we cobble together, I think that's a fair way to put it, solutions for these folks until we can come up with something better. That's not to say that in cases where there are significant impacts to human health that we don't go in and do something right away. But the bottom line is we can't afford as a state to do it all at once, and so we're taking it incrementally. We are hoping through the Clean Water Legacy Act that we can begin to try to provide the kinds of tools that local governments need in order to meet the challenges of, in this case, septic systems, but in other cases it will be wastewater treatment plants that are already there that need to be upgraded, in other cases it will be to provide stormwater infrastructure and so forth.
President Hackworth, I believe that, in my opinion, the Commissioner has been very kind in the fact that a lot of these responsibilities, because of the lack of funding at the state level and not wanting to have the state be the state police around on some of these issues, it's been, we've had the state statutes in place or regulations, but then the enforcement's passed off to the local level. And you can look at a map with regard to straight pipes in the state of Minnesota, people that are not using any septic system or filtration system at all with their personal waste, and you can see some counties that are absolutely loaded with them and other counties that are right next door that are cleaned up and don't have the same problem. That's local enforcement that hasn't taken place. And when the impaired waters program really gets going and we start to identify the TMDL loads in specific water bodies that lead back to the watersheds, and people start to figure out if they don't clean it up, they're not going to be able to grow at all in their community. It's going to hit them economically. All of a sudden, they're going to find it's in their best interest to enforce the common sense laws that we've had on the books for decades. And I think that this is really an issue that's going to be able to push forward some, from an economic standpoint, issues that people would not take seriously from an environmental standpoint.
The point I'm trying to get to, though, Mr. Chairman, is if we know about areas like this where you say there's a county and we know there are all these straight pipes there, it doesn't cost $60 million a year to go and get on those folks. Let's start incrementally and at least clean up those spots where we know those point sources are. I mean, we keep talking about non-point sources. These are point sources we can go and get at. And it's not going to cost $60 million a year to go and shut down these straight pipes and fix these septic systems. Let's get at the issues that we know about.
That's been a challenge. I've had legislation to try and do that very thing for 10 years ago, and couldn't even get hearings on it at that time. So it's we'll see how far we're able to get. Because I'm full agreement with you. I think it'd be wonderful for us to try and get people to just do what they should be doing in the very first place. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hackworth, I'm beginning to see common ground here. I think it would be helpful, Commissioner, if we had the map that Chairman Osment was talking about with the points on the map, and that the committee members would have that. You also have a map a chart that shows urban, a pie chart that shows urban up north and in the agricultural area, that shows these small point sources where they're coming from. Are you familiar with the chart I'm talking about?
I'm not sure, but I'm sure that, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sure that our staff could probably find it for you.
Yes, and I think that would be helpful for us if you would get it to the chair and that we could all visualize the with more specificity where these small point sources are.
Mr. Chair, we'll be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. Would you like to continue the presentation?
I am done with mine. I'd like to hand it over to Art now, if I may, and we'll talk about the Office of Environmental Assistance.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Art Dunn. I'm the Director of the Office of Environmental Assistance. And I want to spend a few minutes this morning giving you a brief overview of the activities that the office has been engaged in. I also want to spend a little bit of time giving some of the history so that you folks will have an appreciation of where we have come from, and also provide you with an update on some of our recent accomplishments, and then look at some of the opportunities or challenges that lie ahead. By way of just a little brief background, I have been within state government since about 1980, back at the point in time that the Waste Management Act was passed, and have been had a variety of duties both inside the Pollution Control Agency and at the Office of Environmental Assistance. And last fall, or a year ago last fall, Commissioner Corrigan asked me to come back and assume the responsibilities as the Director of the Office of Environmental Assistance. I had been there before under the previous Carlson administration, but was back in the Pollution Control Agency. When I was at the Pollution Control Agency, one of the things that I was intimately involved with was helping develop and shape and frame the goal tree and strategic plan that the Commissioner Corrigan had referred you folks to earlier, that the Pollution Control Agency has. And you will note the legal size document that we have attached to our handout that contains the same format, so you'll see a lot of similarities. You'll see a lot of the same type of structure that we try to work directly at and obtain measurable, identifiable, quantifiable outcomes and objectives. And I'll highlight some of that as I move forward in my presentation. Real briefly, the OEA, we are an assistance-based organization. By that, I mean people don't have to come through us to get things. They don't need to come through us, for the most part, to get approvals to do things. We have to try and create the situation that makes them want to come through us. And we have about 60 staff folks that are located both in St. Paul and at regional locations throughout the state. Our budget is somewhere close to $22 million a year. And one of the primary mechanisms that we have used in the past, and I think we'll continue to use, is that we provide that financial assistance as well as technical assistance to folks. That's the lure that brings people in the door that has been used to accomplish some of the things that I'll talk about in a few minutes. That financial assistance, some of the acronyms that you may have heard in the past and will continue to hear, one of them is called SCORE. That refers to a tax which is placed on solid waste collection services. That tax goes into the general fund and into the environmental fund and is passed back through to local units of government, primarily Minnesota counties, and they use those dollars and they have to match those dollars to support local recycling efforts, environmental education efforts, and waste reduction efforts. We also pass through financial help back to Minnesota counties to operate household hazardous waste collection and recycling and disposal programs. We have an agreement with the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which is six of the seven counties here inside the metro area, where we contract with them to pass through money, which is called the LRDG, or Local Development Recycling Grant money. That money comes from a $2 per cubic yard fee, which is placed on solid waste disposal within the metro area. We also pass through money from the pollution prevention account as well as from the environmental fund in a partnership and relationship with MNTAP, the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program, which is head out of the University of Minnesota. And over the last few years, we've had some money, but a declining amount of revenues, where we can pass competitive grants and loans out to either nonprofits or Minnesota businesses or industries or educational groups on a competitive basis in order to help them help us accomplish the outcomes that we have identified in our strategic plan. Our mission is similar to the mission of the Pollution Control Agency. We want to help Minnesotans make informed decisions and to take actions that conserve resources, prevent pollution. One of the things that you folks had spent quite a little bit of time talking earlier about as it relates to the Clean Water Act and some of the issues that are out there, recognizing that prevention is going to be a key element of addressing the issues with water quality and prevent pollution and waste so that we benefit the environment and the economy and society. And I think that you will see the words economy in there as well, which is another linkage to some of the issues that Commissioner Corrigan and the Chair talked about with the impaired waters due to the potential impacts that it could have on the economy of Minnesota. Our vision, as you will see on our strategic plan as well, we would like to see us at a point in time where waste have been prevented and toxicity been reduced. We want to see Minnesotans use materials and products and services in a manner that conserves resources and minimizes waste generation. We'd like to see our communities use resources sustainably and to protect healthy ecosystems, and that Minnesota citizens are environmentally literate. Those things are outlined once again in that goal tree that I handed out. We do have measurable objectives, and we track on an annual basis where we are at in meeting those objectives. And all of our staff have identified specific activities within their work plans that are working to try and achieve those outcomes that we have there. We also focus our financial assistance and granting activities around trying to take measurable, quantifiable steps towards accomplishing the outcomes that are there. want to spend just a few minutes giving you a background on what some of the where we have come from. It says here we spent 25 years developing partnerships that create jobs, foster economic development, and protect public health and the environment. As indicated earlier, over those 25 years, we have operated under several different names. Back in 1980, we were the Waste Management Board. In 1988, we became the Office of Waste Management, and then in 1992, the Office of Environmental Assistance. If we want to think back back to the 70s, and what were some of the conditions like with these elements relative to hazardous waste and solid waste, that was the basic foundation as to why the Waste Management Board was created. In the 1970s, and I had worked for Anoka County during that time in the 1970s, inspecting one of my responsibilities, all of the solid waste disposal facilities, the landfills that were located in that county. We were landfilling virtually all of the solid waste that was generated within the state of Minnesota. We had dwindling capacity at those landfills. There was a need to expand and to create new sites. And as attempts went out and studies started to locate these facilities throughout the state, in particular the metropolitan area, there was a huge outcry on the parts of citizens, in particular those who lived adjacent to where these potential sites were going to occur, that said, we can do better than that. We don't need to do that. We don't want these sites here. The NIMBY, not in my backyard, was prevalent. Relative to hazardous waste, some of you may recall an incinerator located down in Shakopee. It was called the PCI incinerator, I believe. All of the flammable hazardous waste that was generated throughout the state used to go down there to get burned. And I believe it was on the 4th of July in the late 1970s, there was a celebration that was yet to be duplicated, where there was a fire and explosion and barrels exploded and burned for quite some time. So we had a less than desirable system, and we knew that something had to happen to change so that we could do better with managing those materials that were both hazardous as well as solid. So that's kind of some of the background as to why the Waste Management Act was created and the Waste Management Board was given some responsibilities to develop and implement site selection for hazardous waste disposal, as well as help plan out the future and provide some assistance to solid waste planning. In the 80s, you know, we spent most of the time getting the foundation laid. At that point in time, we had the Pollution Prevention Act, we had county planning, we had a certificate of need. We started to develop the infrastructure for grants, capital assistance programs. We started to get at ways that we could start to increase the recycling so that we did not end up having to landfill all of the materials. We, at the Pollution Control Agency, were involved at that point in time in developing the new rules that would require liners underneath these facilities and leachate collection systems so that the liquid that comes out of landfills would have minimum impact on the groundwater. We required that they have financial assistance to a retirement account set up. If you're going to operate these facilities, that you had to figure out how you're going to pay for its retirement health plan, because we knew that the money wouldn't be there unless we started to put it away today. The results of all of those activities resulted in the state having somewhere in the neighborhood of 125 or 130 landfills that they were permitted back at that point in time. People decided that they needed to do something different, and today we're down to about 21 landfills that are currently left operating and receiving the solid waste. What we have created in its stead is more of an integrated system to manage those components so that we don't rely strictly upon one method of managing the materials we call solid waste. We spent the 90s doing this, with the development of SCORE being the solid waste tax that created money to help local units of government develop recycling systems. We developed household hazardous waste management systems. We have developed an infrastructure that a lot of our solid waste goes towards energy recovery, either through mass burn waste to energy facilities, we've started to develop and still have lots of opportunities out there to develop systems to compost that portion of the solid waste stream, which is organic and can be composted. And so what some of the, excuse me, we still have some opportunities that where we can do things to improve on this infrastructure, but that's what our 90s was spent doing. That, creating that basic house and making some improvements to it, you know, has allowed us, I think, as an office to start to look at other areas where we can start to influence and have positive impacts on the environment. In the 2000s, we have started to look at and figure out how can we foster and help on the development of new technologies and looking at, in particular, some of the energy areas and opportunities that are out there. We have spent time dealing with specific problem materials and developing and implementing strategies that hopefully will address them, and bringing others together in partnership to help with that. In particular, our efforts on electronic waste, on carpet and on paint, product stewardship approaches have led us with better understandings, not that we have those problems solved, but at least has allowed us to work together to bring those people to the table that can help solve and create the problems for them. An area of water quality in particular, the efforts of the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program that I mentioned earlier, they've been instrumental most recently in helping municipalities that have phosphorus discharge limits and problems meeting those limits implement phosphorus reduction plans going into the communities, dealing with industries that may be contributing to that, and they've been very successful in helping reduce those phosphorus loadings. In 2002 and 2003, for example, 11 million pounds of water pollutants were reduced by the efforts of the MNTAP program. They also were successful in dealing with businesses and industries so that some 29 million gallons of wastewater that had once been treated no longer needed treatment. So this is some of the future and some of the directions that we think some things going in the future. How have we got there? What have we done? What have we relied upon as the main strategies in order to work with others to achieve these results? Well, as I indicated before, we have provided technical assistance. One example of a recent success, we're involved with General Mills in helping General Mills plant in Shakopee, I believe, reduce manufacturing waste by some 40%. That is saving that company on one line of their manufacturing processes about $345,000 a year. So by just taking it, looking at how they do things, how can they save things, what are ways that they can do to eliminate duplication, eliminate waste, reduce energy use, reduce water use, they're able to do that. We've helped out in the past the Ridgeview Medical Center. And preliminary results are that they will save about 30% on their annual water use just by implementing some pollution prevention activities. They've eliminated about 350 gallons of hazardous waste on a yearly basis, almost a quarter of a million pounds of solid waste, and that will save them somewhere in the neighborhood of $40,000 a year. We have used technical assistance in county planning to help Minnesota counties develop that infrastructure that I talked about before that has allowed us to change how we used to get rid of waste to the more integrated. It's allowed us to change how we used to get rid of waste to the more integrated system that we have out there today. We have also provided financial assistance to counties through the CAP program, Capital Assistance Program, to help them build facilities to either compost or recover energy from waste. By way of some of the results that are out there, there's more waste being processed today at those facilities that exist in the 113 or so closed landfills that are under the closed landfill program. So we're not generating those future brownfields by doing something other than putting it into the ground. Some of our other assistance activities, working with Minnesota WasteWise, that's a nonprofit arm of the Minnesota Chamber, where Minnesota businesses agree to do certain activities to reduce the amounts of waste They're in the bag recycling program, which was started up as a cooperative partnership between grocery stores and some nonprofits. Last year, there was over 24 million plastic bags recycled back into plastic lumber. We're waiting to hear another joint effort with WasteWise. Last year, they entered an agreement with the auto manufacturers and the scrap yards to act as an agent that would collect the mercury switches from automobiles. They entered that activity this past summer. Preliminary indications are that they've been very successful in developing those partnerships with the scrap yards and are getting lots of mercury switches back out, all without having the government operate or do the program as some people had wanted in the past. We also have been working with a group of retired engineers providing technical assistance. It's called RETAP. These are people who have decided that retirement wasn't exactly what they thought it would be and would like to spend a little bit of time engaged in some productive work, so they work fairly cheaply. They, last year, conducted 75 site visits. Most of their activities are at public institutions dealing with local school districts, so it's more of a help to them. And last year, their site visits have resulted in over $100,000 in savings for those 75 places that they visited, focusing on energy, water, and waste use. Education has been one of the things that we also have spent quite a little bit of time on. Our basic education program from the environmental education perspective is to build capacity with others so that others can take things and do it. So we don't go into the classroom and spend a lot of time there, but it's helping and giving others the skills that they can go out and change some of the behaviors, or at least make people aware of the behaviors that they're engaged in. Some of our more positive or more public education attempts, though, have been involved in getting the lead out or the fishing tackle. This started several years ago when we noted on toxic emission releases from Minnesota companies who manufacture lead sinkers was one of the big issues, and we worked with them to change the technology and to change the design of the sinkers to eliminate the lead. And last year, we, through exchanges working with the manufacturers, were able to meet the sportsmen face to face and exchange over a ton of lead sinkers for non-lead sinkers. And those lead sinkers will no longer end up in the gullet of the eagle that Commissioner Corrigan talked about, if we could just get people to do more of that. We annually co-host a Living Green Expo where we're working with other state agencies and manufacturers and other non-governmental organizations, try and expose people to less toxic, less harmful alternative ways of purchasing products. Last year, there was over 10,000 people who attended the event, which is held at the state fairground, and that event is growing on an annual basis. And also last year, over 100,000 people attended our fair booth at the state fair. So we try and maintain exposure, getting information into the hands of people so that people can then make their own decisions. We also have spent time developing and promoting green technologies, in particular working with the Department of Commerce, with the National Energy Renewable Lab out of Colorado, working on this whole concept of fuel cells and the hydrogen economy, because we think there are significant gains that can be made in the long term with those particular approaches. Earlier, I also indicated that we spend, one of our issues is tying back to economics and the jobs and the business growth, the results that some of our activities have been that have occurred. Just from the recycling industry alone in Minnesota last year, there were 9,000 jobs. So we've got 9,000 people working in this state, gainfully employed, with good wages, that are taking what we as individuals put into recycling containers and turning that material back into new products. Those 9,000 jobs are paid somewhere in the neighborhood of $760 million in wages. Some of the trends and some of the challenges and what are some of the opportunities that are out there? Well, there still are issues around waste. We don't have everything solved. Recycling, as indicated, has added some jobs, but some of the markets are and sectors are stressed. Glass has been an issue. What do we do with glass? Plastic recycling is not as high as it should be. Last summer, we went around the state and met with local county solid waste administrators, recycling coordinators, and brought to them the markets. Who are the people who use this material? And we brought with them some people who are experts in transportation so that we could try and work together to create relationships, because those relationships are what's going to make it work. We think that we will result in significant increases in the amount of glass which is recycled. We also have opportunities, I think, to increase significantly the amount of material which is being recycled or being disposed of. Currently, we're landfilling somewhere in the neighborhood of 35% or so of the waste which is generated. About a third of the waste also is going to energy recovery facilities. The most recent waste sorts that we had show that about a third of what is going into energy recovery or landfills is easily recyclable, and there are good markets for it, about 1 million tons of materials per year. So if we look and say it's costing about $45 a ton to get rid of that material, we as a society are spending $45 million a year getting rid of, throwing, quote, away, either into a waste energy facility or a landfill, materials that if we were to recycle them, and all of them are easily recyclable. A lot of it's fiber, some of it's plastic, some of it's paper or organic material. Estimates are, based upon today's market price for those materials, there's $85 million worth of value in there. So something's wrong. We're not taking advantage of the opportunities that are there. There are rooms for to increase the efficiencies. And I've had conversations with both county solid waste officials about this, as well as the private sector haulers about this, as to what can we do, what can they do in order to increase the amounts of materials that are being recovered. Because the opportunities there, the markets are there. I haven't yet figured out, nor have they, I don't think, how to enhance that collection. Toxic chemical, TRI, toxic release inventory. Minnesota manufacturers who emit toxic chemicals are required to report on an annual basis their use, recycling, and emission rates for some of these materials. We have seen a slight reduction in some of these releases, but there are opportunities there as well, I think, to do additional work. If we could just duplicate some of the efforts that Richfield had, that one hospital, the amount of savings that are there, if we could, you know, it might have an impact on healthcare costs. I don't know if we could get all of the hospitals and all the clinics around the state to implement waste reduction, pollution prevention, energy conservation measures. It certainly could contribute, I think, to some of the economies that we see there. Other areas where we have spent time and will continue to spend time is on energy and building use. We have two people in our office who are LEED certified. LEED is an organization that studies and tries to implement policies on green development or energy efficient development. The information we have is that about 65% of our electric use comes from buildings, and if we were to just implement energy saving activities when we construct these buildings, we could save a significant amount of energy there. So we're not a big player in this area, but it's certainly an area that we think energy is one, not once again another source of contamination that we're dealing with. So those are some of the challenges that are out there and the opportunities. And the last opportunity I wanted to briefly touch on, and we can spend more time talking about that, is creating a Department of Environmental Protection. By last fall or last year, I think many of you know, we spent some time talking with various legislators about the opportunity to meld the successes that have occurred from the Pollution Control Agency's history of getting at the pipe, end of pipe, and using the regulatory approach in order to address the cleanup activities that have occurred there, and the Office of Environmental Assistance approach where we have spent significant time developing relationships, changing behavior, working in partnership and collaboration and providing incentives for people, we feel that it's time to have the serious discussion about bringing both of those sets of tools together into a new organization so that we can address and attack the issues that are out there today. If we look back in time, you know, not all of the problems have been solved relative to the waste and to the hazardous waste and the toxicity issues. But we've made great strides in achieving a significantly cleaner environment from the activities that have gone on. And as we move forward, you know, we think that we have greater opportunities. We didn't do this alone. It wasn't the PCA who did this. It wasn't the OEA who did this. And it won't be the PCA or the OEA who achieve the results in the future. We're only 800 or so people at 520 Lafayette Road and scattered throughout the rest of Minnesota. There's 5 million of us, I think somewhere around that at last count, and it's going to take 5 million of us to do things in a conscious way so that we will make the improvements that are needed so that we all will have a better place to live. Your support in the past, as Commissioner Corrigan indicated, I think is critical, and your support in the future is the only way that we can get there. And with that, I will thank you for your time and try and answer questions that you have.
With your last comments with regard to the Department of Environmental Protection, is there a proposal coming forward on this year on that particular issue? And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are still in the process of deciding whether to move that forward. But on a conceptual level, both Art and I are very committed to a new way of doing things. And we think that the Department of Environmental Protection concept is ripe because of all the things that we've been talking about today.
There are questions? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question of Director Dunn here. What are you doing currently with used cooking oil waste? Where does that go now?
Director Dunn?
From restaurants and so on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, I am not. I believe some of it is collected for hog feeding. Yeah. Most of it, I don't believe, is ending up in the waste stream. And there may be some entrepreneurs around the area who are burning it in restaurant mobiles. Yeah, I don't know. That is something which people are doing in other parts of the country. They are have converted their vehicles to burn animal fats and oils. But it's not something that we as an office are directly involved in.
Any other questions? Anyway, thank you very much for your presentations today and the opportunity for us to talk about your successes as well as what you believe we'll be faced with in the future. And looking forward to collaborating with you more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that,
Mr. Chairman,
anything else, Representative Gaines?
Yes, Representative Ellison asked me if I would make an announcement. Is that all right?
Sure.
He has sent an email to all of us about EJAM, the Environmental Justice of Minnesota group, that is hosting a forum on the 22nd. And he's inviting all legislators. I know that some have signed up to come. The thing that I think is going to be the biggest draw is he's having Tyrone Hayes as the keynote speaker at dinner for, and he's the guy who is talking about the deformed frogs and where how the frogs are becoming deformed. There'll be dinner. Dinner is free. I think the only question is signing up. It's going to be held at, you just have to sign up and let them know you're coming. It's going to be held in
at the Urban League in North Minneapolis, and if any of you all think you're going to get lost in North Minneapolis, you can go with me, because I am going to be going and be glad to drive you along. I'm coming over here to pick up some other folks, and I'll be glad to pick up anybody else. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
You're very welcome. Anything else? With that, we are adjourned.